As to how I became a serial killer, well, that's another story and one which, frankly, I'm not sure reflects on me all that well. Hey folks, how are you? Keith Tyler, your volunteer broadcaster, bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sunsounds of Arizona. I am grateful you joined me. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Matt Coward bring us our first story. It's called Splash. Whatever happens, environmental crisis, pandemics, economic collapse, rich people always end up richer, with the sole exception of those events which involve rich people having their heads chopped off. It is largely for this reason that I am strongly in favor of rich people having their heads chopped off on a pretty regular basis. That is only in my personal life, however. During my working hours, my job is to help the wealthy spend their wealth. No matter how silly it may sound to the rest of us, an inability to spend money as fast as it accrues can be a debilitating condition. I have seen it lead to complete breakdown of the personality. If the money comes in quicker than you can spend it, then what's the point of having it? And if there's no point in being rich, then what's the point of you? As to how I became a serial killer, well, that's another story. And one which, well, frankly, I am not sure reflects on me all that well. It was my mother's cousin who first got me into this line of work. I'd left school with no particular plan, other than not to be an office worker like my father or a factory worker like my granddad. Cousin Neville was neither. He was a burglar who later retained as a security advisor. In both professions, his targets were what he called the disgustingly rich. This was quite a precise classification. The insanely rich were no use to him in either of his capacities. Their fortress homes were impregnable to the robber and impenetrable to the freelance chancer, offering them common sense dressed up in buzzworded sales patter. Their security, rather like their homogamous mating, was all taken care of in-house. Now, the merely rich tended to be obsessed, even oppressed, by their wealth, and above all by keeping hold of it. Their lives were governed by the assumption that everyone was out to rob them, so their cash remained in banks, their jewelried lives in safes, and their would-be dream of opening the door to a security advisor who, it stood to reason, was out to rob them. In between these two groups sat the disgustings. Not all rich people have more money than they know what to do with. Many know exactly what they want to do with it. Usually, to move it around carelessly so as to avoid paying tax on it. The disgustingly rich, however, fit the cliché perfectly. They start out with more money than they know what to do with, and then their money breeds in dank and shaded places so that they are constantly besieged by more and more money than they know less and less what to do with. And that's why they need me to do the doing for them. Now, very few people make money. Statistically speaking, if you have money, you almost certainly inherited it. One of my latest clients, Mr. Long, was an exception to that rule. He'd made his pile entirely from scratch, if you don't count his expensive education, which he definitely doesn't. And the way he did it was that he devised a test to establish whether an entity is human or not. The test didn't actually work. Apparently that would have been incredible, but the manner in which it didn't work was considered a huge breakthrough in the artificial intelligence world, and earned him millions. In my modest opinion, he was basically given money for old rope, since finding out whether someone's a human being is simple. Ask them to take their trousers down and sit on the loo. Does the delivery guy immediately ring the front doorbell? But I guess scientists have to complicate things. Mr. Long was reading an article about food banks when I arrived. "Heaven knows, Pewter, I have every sympathy for these people," he told me, which I knew to be rich code for why aren't the police machine-gunning them yet. "But the tragedy of it all is that if only someone were to teach them how to manage their budgets properly, all of their suffering would disappear like smoke. The fact is, I would eat like a king on a pound a day if I chose to." It's a unique and bizarre vanity of the rich, of almost every rich person I have ever met, that they could live happily on tiny amounts of money and that anyone who can't is feckless. I have overheard dinner parties which have turned into Dutch auctions as each loud voice belittles the bid of its predecessor. "If you batch cook and always buy your own brands, you can easily feed 6 children on 50p a day," says one, only to be drowned in cries of 50, more like 30. Every now and then, one such person who is in the public eye is flattered by canny journalists into putting their experiment into action, their triumph recorded on the TV cameras. In many ways, the saddest part of their inevitable and immediate failure is the look of bafflement on their faces. How can they have been wrong? How can the world not be how they knew it was? Once he stopped explaining to me the wasteful ways of the unnecessarily poor, apparently if you do all your cooking at 3 a.m, the electricity's cheaper, so that's a tip worth writing down, Mr. Long and I were able to discuss the reason for my visit, his money, and how to get rid of it. My clients, by the time they engage me, have already bought everything obvious, so my task is to find something that they haven't thought of before and wouldn't have thought of on their own. To this end, I follow trends. I anticipate trends, and sometimes when needs must, I invent trends. The hardest thing to keep your head wrapped around is what I locate for my clients needs to be as expensive as possible. You're not looking for savings or bargains as you would with, say, a moderately well-to-do client. You wouldn't get any credit for coming back to the disgustingly rich with a boast about your brilliant negotiating skills. "I managed to knock them down to $300K. It would be tantamount to a resignation letter. In short, I am not a personal shopper. I am not helping buy ordinary things, even when ordinary means their 15th sports car, their 12th getaway villa, or their 2nd private helicopter. What I do is find them things that they didn't know they needed, which show them why they need them, which, of course, they don't. Sometimes the simple ideas are the best. I persuaded Mr. Long that he needed to take up cycling, and we were currently in the process of spending hundreds of thousands of his pounds on individually designed and handmade bikes, thermally smart gillets, and aerodynamic socks, which involved dozens of sessions in wind tunnels to take score of micro measurements over a period of months. Sometimes I think using up time is just as important to these people as using up cash. My grandfather used to insist that there's an old Polish-Jewish proverb to the effect that you can only wear one vest at a time. My grandfather was Methodist. He never visited Europe in his life, but I'm not going to sit here calling my own grandfather a liar, so fine. Let's accept that Polish Jews rarely speak of anything else. If so, the proverb misses the point. It isn't using the second vest that matters, it's owning it. Functionality is of central significance only to the poor. Something else you've got to keep in mind is that the rich are beyond parity. One example only, otherwise we'll be here all day. For a while, I used to supply my clients with invisible artworks. I would be lying in bed at night chuckling, smug at my daring, my imagination, my refusal to be trammeled by the bounds of mere realism. Then someone invented non-fungible tokens and my smugness evaporated. The rich are beyond parity, and self-parity is beyond them. The first killing upset me, really, quite a lot. The later violence less so. I won't deny, but Mrs. Whitlow was a nice old thing, and I was sorry to lose her. I believe she employed my services mainly because it gave her someone to talk to. True, she suffered from the generalized fear, along with all the disgustingly rich, of seeing their money pile up until it threatened to bury them in an avalanche of unspent accumulation. But in her, I never spotted the suppressed panic so common in my other clients. She was a widow, with no family left. She'd given up her friends long ago in the service of becoming rich, and she couldn't stand her acquaintances. She had few visitors other than me and her cleaning service. Once or twice a week, we would spend an hour or two idly socializing, at the end of which, because she understood how a deal works, I would start to describe something which she might spend a few grand on. And she'd just wave her hand at me as if to say, "Oh, of course, my dear, whatever you think best." Mrs. Whitlow was the only client who made me feel like a prostitute. She was the only one who made me feel like a person, too. I was the person while we sat and chatted, and then effectively paid off at the end for my company. I became a prostitute. Her late husband had inherited the wealth which she had subsequently inherited from him, but she would vigorously dispute the idea that she hadn't worked for it. "If I worked for it a damn sight more than he did," she told me on our first meeting. "All he had to do was inherit it. I had to marry a complete prat who inherited it." She sighed, as at a painful memory. "And then there was the perverted sex," she added. I swallowed my horrible coffee noisily. "The perverted? Well, yes," said Mrs. Whitlow. "I had to give all that up, didn't I?" Being fond of her, I didn't want to be the cause of her spending uncomfortable hours being measured up for bicycles she'd never ride, or put her thoughts of indignity of having a shaman rid her house of negative energies. So I tried to spend her money in ways which would inconvenience her as little as possible. One thing I signed her up for on that basis, tragically as it turned out, was ruffling. I've always taken satisfaction in devising schemes which can help out a friend who is down on their luck, and at the same time give me something I can sell to my clients. One of these friends, an old schoolmate, in fact, was Ozzy, chronically unemployed after the Metropolitan Police decided that they could probably manage without his help. You might say that someone who got to be pretty extraordinarily awful to be sacked by the Met, but in his defense, Ozzy always pointed out that it wasn't really his fault. It was the fault of the methamphetamine. When he was straight, which was most of the time since his sacking, other than the periodic booze bender, he was a presentable young man with an air of discretion and deference, which made him the ideal ruffler. Fashions come and go, and in my work I try to follow them in, keep them company for a while, and then let them find their own way out. the fashion for wearing your hair in a manner which suggests you've just got out of bed is a slightly risky one for the rich. There is a danger that messy hair might convey the message that you simply haven't had your hair done. Fortunately, you can say goodbye to that particular terror by employing the services of a professional trained hair ruffler and letting it be known that you do so. In exchange for a retainer, Ozzy is supposed to be at the end of a phone 24 hours a day. He gets a text from someone who urgently needs their hair ruffled, and he whizzes around on a scooter, dons his white cotton gloves, and runs his fingers artistically through the client's mop while emitting little French-sounding noises of satisfaction or despair. Most clients who sign up for it use the service once, maybe three times, and then can't be bothered anymore. But they almost never get round to canceling the monthly payment. And yes, since you are cynical enough to ask, he is trained. When I first came up with the plan, I spent at least 10 minutes ruffling his own hair in front of a mirror to show him what I had in mind. I was in hospital when Ozzy phoned.
"Hey, mate, I've just had a ping from Mrs. Whitlow," he told me. "She needs ruffling."
I sniffed. The great thing about mobile phones is that they are such crap technology. Even after all these years, if we'd been on a landline, Ozzy could have heard the tears at the back of my throat.
So, listen, Pewter, you're going to have to take this one.
And yes, even through the crap technology, I could make out the slight slurring of his voice.
The idea is that you're available 24 hours out of 24, Ozzy. That's why I pay you a retainer, in order to retain you. Oh, mate, listen, I've never let you down before.
This was the fourth time in 2 months.
But honestly, seriously, you don't want me turning up there right now. I'm not in a great state. If I turn up like this, I'm going to scare your client half to death.
Just what I need. Just when I didn't need it.
You're a useless sod, Ozzy. Certain occurrences have happened to me, Pewter, and I'm not at my best.
It was never his fault. Always blame the drugs. As I hung up, grinding my teeth, my aunt arrived to sit by my gran's bed. We hugged without embracing and spoke quietly, like shift workers handing over.
"Suppose we shouldn't be surprised," said my aunt. "She's not been great since last Christmas."
I shrugged.
"Well, apparently one or other of her neighbors goes in every other day, so she was never going to lie on her own for long."
"Well, that's a comfort, anyway. Is she unconscious?"
I gave my aunt's arm a comforting squeeze.
No, she's just sleeping. They've given her loads of painkiller. I managed a few words with her early, though I'm not sure she really knew who I was. In the morning, they're going to give her a test for dementia."
My aunt snorted a laugh very quietly.
"I hope they don't ask her who the Prime Minister is. Nurses shouldn't have to hear that sort of language."
I rarely drive in London. It's just not worth it. I mostly use taxis, occasionally buses or tubes. At 10 to 7 that morning, and that far out from the center of town, there were no taxis. So rather than waiting at a bus stop, I decided to set off on foot. I was probably 20 minutes walk from Mrs. Whitlow's house, perhaps half that if I jogged it. I am not, and never have been, a jogger. Jogging was a big mistake. Almost in sight of Mrs. Whitlow's, I tripped on an uneven paving slab and went down like a sack of idiots. I scraped myself off the ground and hobbled the last few yards to Mrs. Whitlow's door. She answered the ring of the doorbell, and for a moment she didn't scream. But then she screamed. My glasses, broken in the fall, were in my jacket pocket. My jacket and my trousers were both torn, and everything that wasn't torn was smeared in mud. My nose and my lower lip were both bleeding. I hadn't slept since I woke up this time yesterday, and I'd spent much of the night crying.
I was panting and doubled over from the jogging. Mrs. Whitlow was still screaming as she took an involuntary step backwards away from the unrecognizable, frightening figure looming on her doorstep before sunrise on a winter's day. She fell over while retreating and banged her head on the hall table. And that stopped the screaming. Nobody reacts rationally to death. If you think you do, you're either wrong or you're a psychopath. On the fatal table, there was a cup of coffee. She must have put it there to free her hand while she undid the latch on the front door. All I can say is I thought it might revive her. It bloody should do. The stuff from her coffee system works out at about 30 pounds per cup. I told her it was the only one in the country, but strictly speaking, that is not true. In the sense that it is, in fact, untrue. I have brokered, we don't use the word sold in my business, it reeks of commonplace, a dozen of them to various clients, and I've got another dozen or so in my lockup awaiting their new homes. I imported them wholesale, which, needless to say, is another banned quotidian term. I got them for next to nothing and more or less exclusively throughout the UK because they only take one particular brand of coffee, which just happens to be horrible. My clients don't care, of course. They're not drinking the coffee because it tastes nice. They are drinking it because it costs nice. I took the coffee cup in my hand and knelt next to Mrs. Whitlow, saying her name gently but firmly. But that close to her, I could see the blood beneath her head, and I could see her vacant eyes. Now I screamed, staggered backwards, tripped. That hallway was an absolute death trap. The coffee went flying all over Mrs. Whitlow's 1,000-quid bedroom slippers. I lay there for a while. The second time that night, I'd found myself flat out, hurting. I wondered why she needed to have her hair made to look as if she had just got out of bed when, in fact, she had just got out of bed. At the end of a lonely, sleepless night, it was perhaps the only cry for help that came to mind. I dragged myself upright, determined this time to check properly. I did, and she was. Mrs. Whitlow was dead, and her slippers were ruined. I spent a while standing there feeling horrified, first for her and then for me. A death like this would make the news, both for the grimly comical absurdity of its details and for the wealth of its victim. And when it did, my business would be ruined. One thing rich people will not tolerate is being laughed at. If my name became associated with what had happened here, I could be finished overnight. The best I could, I gathered myself together, the bits that were still working at any rate, and I tried to flee the scene more quietly than I had arrived. The death of Mrs. Whitlow was not discovered for 2 days, which made me sad and nervous. I spent those 2 days waiting for the police to call. I visited my granny once. She knew me this time, but she wasn't cheerful, it having become clear to her that she was going to be in hospital for the foreseeable. I didn't tell her that she was my standby alibi. She had enough to fret about. Forensic traces were not going to be a problem. I was a frequent and legitimate visitor to Mrs. Whitlow, so my fingerprints on her front door, her hall table, or her coffee cup were of no significance. Provided no one saw me at her house on that specific morning, I should be in the clear. If the police asked if I was there, I'd just deny it. Even if the cops traced Ozzy through the text she'd sent him, asking him for a ruffling, and he'd reported our conversation to them, I'd just fall back on my sick granny. Yes, officer, I was meant to go there, but in that end I was so upset about Gran that I couldn't face it. Even better, in case they were able to track me to Mrs. Whitlow's vicinity. Yes, officer, I started out for her house, but was overcome with grief before I arrived, and so I turned back.
your witness? Must be confusing that morning with some other morning. I was often there. Without my side of the story to add the color elements, the multiple pratfalls, the broken glasses, the bloody nose, the suspicious death of a disgustingly rich recluse made the local TV news, but not yet the national. The police made clear that they saw it as an attempt at robbery. The thief probably shoved the old woman to gain entry through the door or grabbed her to silence her, and that was what caused the mortal fall. But back in the local news studio, one woman had a different theory. The caption at the bottom of the screen named her as Tabitha Thompson, Controversial Profiler. Did you need different qualifications, I wondered, to be a controversial profiler instead of an anodyne one? Tabitha was there to warn the world, the police, the media, the citizenry of London, that this was not, as everyone else mistakenly believed, an isolated murder. It was, rather, the first strike of a serial killer. She knew that because of the coffee and the luxury slippers. Well, well, I thought, and here I'd been worried about the pratfalls as the nugget that would snag media attention. The coffee and the slippers hadn't crossed my mind.
Yes, the symbolism is unmistakable, explained Tabitha to a bemused anchor. A little hackneyed, perhaps, but indisputable. The killer is saying your ludicrous wealth keeps us on our knees, and now we are rising.
The internet firmed that I had deduced. Dr. Tabitha Thompson had been a leading criminal profiler and an academic with a sideline in police consultation, which itself had led to a sideline in media appearances, true crime books, and general celebrity. But then it had all gone wrong, and I was sure I knew why. When you've grown up in the house of a topper, you see the signs without needing to look for them. It's not something you consciously learn or are ever taught. It's just something you recognize as naturally as you recognize your own front door. I'm not talking about a red-nosed, staggering type of drunk. The sort I was familiar with was the one who smells of perfume or cologne, but too much perfume or cologne and too much mouthwash, whose clothes are perfectly respectable but seem to have been put on at an odd angle. Speech not slurred but too emphatic, eyes not drowsy but anxious. The sort of drinker who not only comes up with crazy ideas, which will free them from all their troubles in one bound, but who goes ahead and acts on them. If I can just pull this stunt off, clear my debts, get my career back on track, then I can sort out the boozing, get my life straightened out, and life can start again. I grew up seeing that look, and I saw it now on the TV screen. Tabitha's last high-profile profiling job had gone so badly, it had become a meme. When the killer was eventually arrested, she had got the sex, the race, the age, the geography, and the occupation not only wrong, but hilariously wrong. She hadn't been heard of since. Until this morning. I knew the look. And I knew that Tabitha Thompson had convinced herself, with the warm and willing assistance of the drink, that she had found a serial killer no one else had spotted. She could feel the excitement in her stomach floating on the booze. She was on her way back to the top, and this time, when she got there, she'd deal with the addiction once and for all. She'd mend the relationships. She'd do it all again, but this time, she'd do it right. Despite her fall, she'd obviously managed to maintain at least one contact in the Met, because she was now telling the TV anchor about the exclusivity of Mrs. Whitlow's coffee, how it was almost impossible to get in this country, how it was considered the height of chic among those with more money than brain cells, how each cup full cost £60,
The only thing she didn't seem to know about was that it tasted like the medicine you'd give to a dying rat. The media obviously didn't believe the controversial profiler's controversial nonsense. Her drinking would be no secret within those circles. But equally obviously, they loved the story. Whether she turned out to be right or wrong, either way, they'd have a sensation. Standards in modern journalism had fallen so low that they presumably thought captioning her as a controversial was a full and final discharge of their duty to care to the concept of truth. The next morning's papers obligingly came up with a name for her imaginary serial offender, the Coffee Spiller Killer. The detective sergeant who finally came to interview me was a friendly chap about my age with a soft North Wales accent. "It's odd, isn't it?" he said to me, sitting over a cup of ordinary drinkable coffee in my flat. I nodded. Many things are," I agreed. "Isn't it odd that how the poor spend their money is a subject of endless discussion and disapproval?" "Well, I've never thought about it," I told him. "You hear people say, how can they be refugees when they're wearing decent shoes? How come she's claiming welfare benefits, but she can afford to eat an ice cream? My granny used to say it about her neighbors. They say they're unemployed, but they've still got a TV aerial on the roof." "Yeah, I suppose so." "But the rich," said the DS, "they spend their money largely unobserved and wholly unsupervised, except by, well, you, I suppose." It was true. Our society is obsessed with spending habits of those who have little to spend, which now the DS came to mention it did seem a bit wrong way round. "It does seem a little unfair," I agreed. "But I guess if fairness was the thing, then there wouldn't be any rich in the first place." He nodded. "And there certainly wouldn't be any poor." He finished his coffee and continued to explain the workings of the world to me. "During economic trouble times, the premium end of any given market always grows. If there's a recession on and you sell cheap cars, you're in trouble, because the people who buy cheap cars can't afford to buy cars anymore. Whereas if you sell luxury cars, you will find your sales go up." "Because poor people can't get poorer without rich people getting richer," I said. "Exactly," said the DS. "When one end of the seesaw goes down, the other end has to go up. That's not even economics, it's just physics." He took my statement, untrue and unhelpful as it was, and then, just as I was showing him out, he said, "I believe in being honest with people, Mr. Pewter, so I'm going to say this. I fancy you for this killing. I believe that you saw all the precious things in Mrs. Whitlow's house during your frequent visits, and that you decided that they were doing no good there and that they would be more useful in your possession."
"I'm sorry to hear that," I said, my mouth dry and my voice croaky.
"I don't think you set out to kill her, but if it was an accident, you need to talk to us. And make it soon, yes? Before things escape your control altogether."
Before he shook my hand and left, he said one last thing.
"You know, it seems to me that there is an underlying pointlessness to great wealth which perhaps only reveals itself at the moment of death."
I sat on my sofa after he'd gone, coming to terms with the terrifying fact that I was clearly the main focus of the investigation. Mrs. Whitlow had very few visitors, of which I was one. They knew from talking to Ozzie that I was due to visit her that morning, and that they had only my word for it that I had changed my mind and gone home instead. And that was when I began to think about Tabitha Thompson, controversial profiler, and her mad theory about a maddened avenger. There are few things more annoying than having to murder someone on your day off, although football commentators whose stress random words come close. I don't get many days off. They don't really fit my business model. Being always available is not so much something the rich demand or even expect. They take it for granted, like the rising of the sun or the air that they breathe. From what I had read, I gathered that a killer only becomes a serial killer when he has killed 3 victims. So I had 2 more to go. I couldn't kill 2 more of my own clients because the link would be too obvious. I would have to select 2 victims who were disgustingly rich and unconnected to me. But how did I gain access to them? In approaching my targets, I couldn't phone, text, email, write, or send an inquiry with a trumpet. Inquiries with trumpets are undoubtedly available to hire somewhere in London, but like everyone, they would provide a paper trail. I could send a pigeon, I suppose, if I had a pigeon or if I knew how to use one. In fact, I couldn't approach them as myself in any way. In case they wrote me down in an appointment book or mentioned it to someone, a servant, a doorman, even someone on the phone. Oh, got a rush, I'm meeting a guy about. Instead, I would have to turn up in their presence, uninvited, unobserved, unanticipated. But I couldn't break into their house because, well, how do you break into well-secured houses? Do you know? I could probably manage to break into a garden shed if you gave me a crowbar and didn't set a time limit, but I don't have the first idea about alarm systems and smart locks. Murder is simple. Burglary is skilled. The more I thought about it, the more I came to the depressing conclusion that it was going to have to be outside, in the open air, somewhere with no locks, no alarms, no CCTV, no doorman, no records, no witnesses. Depressing because these are millionaires. They go from private lift to a private car park to the limousine. They don't stand at bus stops waiting to be killed. In the end, it was the detective sergeant's boss speaking on the radio news who gave me my answer. "Eventually this case will be solved," she told the interviewer, "as such cases usually are, by the application of good old-fashioned leatherwork." At first I assumed this meant beating people with truncheons until they confessed to things they hadn't done, and I was impressed by the detective's inspector's candor until she further explained that police work is about wearing out your shoes, interviewing, re-interviewing, observing, following up on dead-end leads. In short, there are no shortcuts. Persistence, doggedness, attention to detail, that's how we get results. This all sounded very unlikely to me. Aren't most serial killers caught by accident when they're stopped for having a faulty brake light? Though I could see why detectives preferred a self-image of the police as tireless pursuers. More to the point, I now knew what I had to do. Although most of the disgustingly rich never set physical foot on the streets of London, let alone alone, the laws of probability meant that some must do. This city is said to contain more millionaires than any other on earth. And surely, amongst their number, there had to be the odd jogger, 10,000 steps a day fanatic, dog walker, or solo Tai Chi in the park enthusiast. And remember, I only needed 2 to get my badge. Due to the nature of my business, I started with an advantage. I already knew an awful lot about the members of the disgustingly rich community. I had in my files the names and addresses of scores of potential clients that could easily find more, and potential clients were potential victims. So began my leatherwork. For 6 days and nights, scarcely without sleep other than moments sitting upright on park benches, I tracked the rich, all day, every day, all night when necessary. I had a little time to play with. Serial killers characteristically leave gaps between their crimes, but not too long. I needed to confirm Tabitha's hypothesis quickly, so that the police would start looking for her phantom murderer and lose interest in me. 6 exhausting days, and then on the 7th, I killed Edward Sharp in the residence gardens attached to the block of luxury apartments which held his London home. I said before that most people inherit their money. Not Edward Sharp. Property speculator and tax evader. He made his the old-fashioned way, by stealing it from poor people. I was worried that the change in M.O. might undermine the serial killer illusion, but I knew I couldn't reproduce the method of Mrs. Whitlow's death. You could spend all week pushing millionaires over and not get lucky once. Browsing some books in a reference library, the internet leaves traces, I was persuaded of the benefits of the garrote, or ligature. The wire I upcycled from a skip in a street far from my own, for the handles I relied on bits of tree or brush found at the murder site. Because Tabitha Thompson had made such a big deal about the coffee and the exclusivity of its brand, I had to lug a travel mug of the filthy stuff all across town, concealed it in a messenger's satchel. I splashed it all over the dead man's trousers and set off on the long, circuitous walk home. Did I feel guilty about killing? Well, yes, of course I did. I'm not a monster, or even, except in Tabitha's imagination, a driven avenger. But you know, you do have to bear in mind my victim. Rich people aren't real people, are they? The coffee spiller killer represents a parabolic revolt against austerity and plutocracy and kleptocracy, Tabitha was telling the TV news national news this time, not local, her face glowing with a mixture of energy and vodka. Despairing of political solutions in a hollowed-out democracy, a disempowered, dispossessed, and declassified former proletariat has, in its frustration, issued forth, projected, if you like, a kind of golem or goblin, one might also say an animus. "You're not suggesting that the killer is a supernatural thing?" asked the presenter, transparently hoping that she was suggesting precisely that. "No, but what I am saying is that his, her, or their actions are in a neo-Jungian sense a physical manifestation of a nation's fury." "Rubbish, all of it. I wasn't furious about anything. I'd got life sorted very nicely, thank you. Or at least I had before all this started. If I was furious about anything, which comes to think of it, I obviously was, it was having to kill people deliberately so as to cover up having killed someone accidentally. That and, well, and the price of coffee. I needn't have fretted about the change in murder method. Dr. Thompson weaved this happily into her narrative. By deliberately choosing a different mode of execution, he is explicitly drawing our attention to the motives, the coffee, the victims. What is important and what is not important? He is saying, we will use whatever means we must. It's only the results that matters. My second chosen victim made a fortune during the pandemic. Old college pals now in government giving him contracts for PPE equipment, which had to be incinerated because it was faulty. So it was with something approaching satisfaction that I slipped the ligature around his neck and began to tug. I had observed that he took a walk on this particular stretch of Clapham Common every night around midnight. He didn't have a dog. I suspect he was looking for courting couples to spy on, though I fully accepted that this might just be my prejudice showing. If anyone saw me attacking him, I planned to claim by way of mitigation that he tried to proposition me. "That's enough, Mr. Pewter. Drop it." My friend, the Welsh DS, enveloped me from behind, seizing my wrists and forcing them up, then down, around, and behind my back. Another cop was helping the gasping but still alive victim, while a third told a handheld radio to send the paramedics forward. I felt unexpected and uncharacteristic contempt for all three officers. Is that really what the state is here for? To protect crooks like him from hardworking citizens like me? As I believed I mentioned when we last met, Mr. Puta, the DS reminded me as we sat in the police interview room, I considered you a viable suspect from early on. My solicitor, sitting next to me, tapped my hip with her knuckles as a signal to remain silent. Mrs. Whitlow opened the door to her attacker, the DS continued, so it was likely that she knew him. You were one of the very few people she ever invited across her threshold. Motive? He gave me a friendly smile. Well, maybe robbery. More likely because you have developed an ungovernable hatred for the rich you serve. If he was saying that the police took the serial killer theory seriously from the start, then that was an irony I could have lived without. Then there was the coffee, wasn't there? A certain publicity-hungry so-called expert on the television made a great deal of the fact that the coffee found splashed across Mrs. Whitlow's feet was of a type rare in this country. "I wonder where she got that information from," said my solicitor, with an innocent voice for the tape and a naughty smile designed to annoy the DS. "That side issue is indeed under investigation," he replied. "More importantly, were you quickly able to establish that Mr. Pewter is one of only three people in the UK licensed to import this brand of coffee, and the only one actively doing so?" "No, no, no," said the solicitor, more seriously now. "You're trying two bites at the same cherry, Detective Sergeant. My client was a regular visitor to Mrs. Whitlow precisely because he sold her such items as the exclusive coffee. You are attempting to make two clues out of one innocent fact." The DS conceded her point with a wry nod. "Messenius took the same view. As I shall be making clear at my press conference later today, it was largely due to the budget restraints that I was refused permission to place your client under surveillance following Mrs. Whitlow's death, a false economy which cost a man his life." Silently I toasted all myopic governments and their self-defeating austerities. "This changed, as you can imagine," said the DS, "after the second killing. The fact that the same rare brand of coffee had been used as a signature at both scenes, and that Mr. Pewter was not only one of the few people to have access to that coffee, but also was connected to the first locus, made it clear that we had identified a prime suspect. Approval was given to place your client under close surveillance, and as a result..." There was a loud and urgent knock at the door, followed before its echo had even faded by the door flying open and a young detective sliding through it. He crouched down to whisper to the DS, but we all heard him, his voice amplified by shock.
"There's been another one."
"There's what?"
"Another coffee killing."
The DS turned his bloodless face in my direction.
"But I caught you in the act."
The lawyer held up a hand. "My client is scarcely in a position to dispute any charge of assault which may arise out of this evening's events, Detective Sergeant. But equally, he can hardly be your coffee spiller if your coffee spiller is still out there spilling coffee." The DS ignored her, or perhaps didn't hear her. His eyes were still locked on mine.
"I'm sure you killed that old woman. I bloody know you killed the rich man. And I saw you with me own eyes trying to kill the one tonight."
"And yet," I said, crucially recovering from my shock faster than he was from his, "the coffee spiller killer evidently remains at liberty, free to terrorize the city. Your seniors won't be pleased."
"Who the hell would do this?" he said.
I thought the answer to that was obvious, but I certainly wasn't going to help him work it out. Someone desperate. Someone who knows that if they can just somehow pull off this one insane but brilliant stunt, they'll be able to start their life all over again, and this time they'll do it right. When you've grown up seeing that look, you know it at a glance, and I'd known it the first time I saw her on the TV screen. All right, folks, after that lengthy story, but one I hope you enjoyed, some laughs, some twists, let's go now to the Playboy Book of Crime and Suspense, a story called The Hobbyist, and it's written by Frederick Brown. I heard a rumor, Sangstrom said, to the effect that you... He turned his head and looked about him to make absolutely sure that he and the druggist were alone in the tiny prescription pharmacy. The druggist was a gnome-like, gnarled little man who could have been any age from 50 to 100. They were alone, but Sangstrom dropped his voice just the same. To the effect that you have a completely undetectable poison. The druggist nodded. He came around the counter and locked the front door of the shop, then walked toward a doorway behind the counter.
"I was about to take a coffee break," he said. "Come with me and have a cup."
Sangstrom followed him around the counter and through the doorway to a back room ringed by shelves of bottles from floor to ceiling. The druggist plugged in an electric percolator, found two cups and put them on the table, and had a chair on either side of it. He motioned Sangstrom to one of the chairs, and took the other one himself.
"Now," he said, "tell me, whom do you want to kill, and why?"
"Does it matter?" Sangstrom asked. "Isn't it enough that I pay for—" The druggist interrupted him with an upraised hand.
"Oh, yes, it matters. I must be convinced that you deserve what I can give you. Otherwise,"
he shrugged. "All right," Sangstrom said. "The whom is my wife. The why?" He started the long story. Before he had quite finished, the percolator had completed its task, and the druggist briefly interrupted to get the coffee for them. Sangstrom concluded his story. The little druggist nodded.
"Yes, I occasionally dispense an undetectable poison. I do so freely. I do not charge for it, if I think the case is deserving. I have helped many murderers."
"Fine," Sangstrom said. "Please, give it to me then." The druggist smiled at him.
"I already have. By the time the coffee was ready, I had to decided that you deserved it. It was, as I said, free. But there is a price for the antidote."
Sangstrom turned pale, but he had anticipated not this, but the possibility of a double cross or some form of blackmail. He pulled a pistol from the pocket. The little druggist chuckled.
"You daren't use that. Can you find the antidote," he waved at the shelves, "among those thousands of bottles? Or would you find a faster, more virulent poison? Or if you think I'm bluffing that you are not really poisoned, go ahead and shoot. You'll know the answer within 3 hours when the poison starts to work."
"How much for the antidote?" Sangstrom growled.
"Oh, quite reasonable. $1,000. After all, a man must live. Even if his hobby is preventing murders, there's no reason why he shouldn't make money at it, is there?"
Sangstrom growled and put the pistol down, but within reach, and took out his wallet. Maybe after he had the antidote, he'd still use the pistol. He counted out $1,000 in $100 bills and put them on the table. The druggist made no immediate move to pick them up. He said, "And one other thing, for your wife's safety and mine, you will write a confession of your intention, your former intention, I trust, to murder your wife. Then you will wait until I go out and mail it to a friend of mine on the homicide detail. He'll keep it as evidence in case you ever do decide to kill your wife, or me, for that matter. When that is in the mail, it will be safe for me to return here and give you the antidote. I'll get you paper and pen. One other thing. Although I do not absolutely insist on it, please help spread the word about my undetectable poison, will you? One never knows, Mr. Sangstrom, the life you save, if you have any enemies, just might be your own." Well, folks, that's going to finish up this episode of the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler saying thank you so very, very much for joining me. And tune in again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.